First, an unhappy marriage, then a happy one, mourning a beloved dog, and some great advice for writers.
My dream, and this has actually really worked, is that I would answer every single question that people have ever asked me about writing, so that when somebody comes up and asks me those questions, I can now say, give me your email address. I wrote this really long essay called The Getaway Car, and I'll send it to you.
That's Ann Patchett. We talk with her about her collection of essays, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Then we re-air our 2012 interview with Patchett's mother, Jean Ray, also a writer, about her novel, Calling Invisible Women. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Ann Patchett always knew she was going to be a writer. As she writes in her marvelous collection of essays culled from decades of work, she knew this as long as she's known everything. She started out writing quite young for the magazine 17 and went on to the likes of the Atlantic Monthly and Harper's. Although perhaps best known for her novels like Bel Canto and State of Wonder, Patchett's essay collection, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, introduces the reader to her straightforward, clear-eyed, and honest personal voice, refreshing like a cold mint tea on a hot day. Most of the essays are personal, revealing the happiness, sadness, and above all, the poignancy of life in its multiple roles as writer, wife, daughter, and even human companion to a well-loved dog. Well, Ann Patchett, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This collection of nonfiction writings, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Some of the pieces are about writing, some are just about life, some are new, some are old. Why did you make that the title story?
Because it was a good title. You know, I really thought about all the different titles, and, you know, I could retitle something if it would work best as a title. For a long time, I was going to call the book The Mercies after the last piece, and that wasn't quite strong enough. But on one hand, I think that This is the Story of a Happy Marriage is a terrifying title because, of course, it's like saying my children are beautiful and love me and have no interest in methamphetamine. You know, it's kind of bringing the evil eye onto yourself in a way. But I also thought, as a bookstore owner, I thought, boy, if I walked into a bookstore and saw a book that said, this is the story of a happy marriage, I would pick it up. And I also think that it became a book about all of the things I was married to. It's a story about all the different things in my life I'm committed to, family, friends, books, work, dogs, and so it seemed to work.
Yeah, it's really a lovely piece. But I want to talk about it a little bit later, because one of your longer pieces in the book is about writing. And I rarely, you know, usually on this show, I talk to writers about their books, which are not about writing. And sometimes we talk a little bit about writing at the end. But here's a chance to talk to a wonderful novel writer about a wonderful piece, The Getaway Car. Is that what it's called again?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, The Getaway Car. So are you willing to delve into that one?
Sure, absolutely. That was a funny story. I was giving a talk in Chicago, and a woman followed me into the bathroom. It was right before I went on, and she said, I work for Byliner, and I didn't understand what Byliner was. I didn't understand what Byliner was, I don't think, until after the piece came out. She said, I really want you to write a very long format essay. And that was right about the time I was starting to think about doing this book, and I was wanting to write some longer pieces, but it was also just really funny because I was about to go on and do this presentation, and this woman was pitching me in the bathroom, basically, to write this piece. And she said, yeah, I said, what do you want me to write about? She said, anything. It just needs to be really long. So I thought about what it was that I wanted to say for 50 pages. And I went on to give this talk, and I was talking a lot about writing, and people were asking me a lot of questions about writing. And so I thought, well, okay, you know, I'll basically write about this. all of these things that I'm asked no matter where I go. And my dream, and this has actually really worked, is that I would answer every single question that people have ever asked me about writing, so that when somebody comes up and asks me those questions, I can now say, give me your email address. I wrote this really long essay called The Getaway Car, and I'll send it to you. And it's really served me so well in the year since I wrote it, because people will say to me all the time, you know, will you have lunch with my daughter? She's a freshman in college and she really wants to be a writer. Will you meet with my son? He's trying to decide if he wants to go to graduate school. And I always say, okay, yes, I will. But first they have to read this essay. And if at the end of reading this essay, they have any question for me, I'll meet with them. And never once has anyone wanted to meet with me. I just don't know if that's because they figure I'm so boring that they wouldn't actually want to have lunch with me after they read the essay, or if I did, in fact, manage to do what I set out to do, which is I answered all the questions.
And I really think you did. I mean, it was a very satisfying, and you know, a lot of writers write about writing, and I usually do find it boring. This one I did not find boring, because you were answering a lot of my questions and making me really confront my whole writing process as well. Now, one of the most important things you say in this chapter is that writing is about practice, about doing it.
Yeah.
The hour a day is problematic that I found it, because it's never an hour. It's like 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours. And then you're lost. You know, then, yes, you maybe written a lot, but you haven't gotten all the other things done, and then you feel like, I feel like I've gotten lost. So there has to be something about discipline and structure, as well as just sitting down an hour a day.
Well, I think that maybe you have a different problem, which is maybe you have too much to say, but I feel like 99% of the people that I talk to who really want to write don't write. They just don't get to it. And that if you can confront that basic issue of saying, this is the most important thing in my life, this is the thing I want above all else, so why am I not just committing a certain amount of time every day to do it?
Yeah, so let's start at the beginning. So starting a novel, you have a wonderful description about how you live with a novel first. And tell us about that.
I do, and I am right now. I have a novel in my head that on one hand is pretty much ready to go, although there's a whole sort of chunk in the narrative arc I haven't figured out. But I find this part of the process the most pleasant. When I'm just walking around and kind of thinking about things, you know, it's the difference between fantasizing about your wedding when you don't have a boyfriend and planning a wedding or getting married. You know, one is a very dreamy, happy experience, and one is really miserable. And I think that the actual work of writing can be really miserable, but the dreamy planning is lovely. And I'm always kind of happiest when I feel like I have a good idea for a novel and I can kick it around in my head, but I'm not actually sitting down and doing the work of it.
Also, you talk about how you got into this. I mean, first you almost always knew that you wanted to be a writer, and then you went to college and studied mostly short story writing. You also studied with some pretty amazing people. Grace Paley. Tell us a little bit about studying with her.
Grace Paley was just... I still can't believe that I spent a year with Grace. And that's the thing, these classes at Sarah Lawrence, they were a year long, and there were, I don't know, 12 or 14 people in the class. It was really small, and you stayed with these people all year. And Grace's attention was very hard to get. She was often gone saving the world. She had her eyes on much larger issues than our short stories, and I felt often hurt and neglected, and I was a quiet student and also somebody who always got my work done on time, and I always did exactly what I was told. I was the product of 12 years of Catholic girls' school, so going to Sarah Lawrence was a funny experience for me. But Grace really did have a larger lesson, which was keeping your eye on the problems of the world was a much more important calling than writing a short story, which I think is why she didn't turn out a large body of work in her life. But she led a very important life, and the stories that she wrote, I think, are essential. They're just breathtaking. She put so much focus and life and light and energy into everything that she did write, but she also raised two kids and had two marriages and worked tirelessly for peace, be it on the neighborhood level or on the world level. And that was the lesson she had to teach us. You know, she wanted us to be better people, more interesting people, so we would be better writers.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ann Patchett about her marvelous collection of essays, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. It's out from HarperCollins. And that leads into also something that Russell Banks told you, who you also studied with.
Yeah. Russell told me, and Russell, I see Russell, you know, every couple of years, and he always says, I have no remembrance saying this to you. But he said, you have to make the decision if you want to write great art or great television. He said, you know, you're a really good writer. And I was 20 at the time. He said, you're a really good writer. Nobody else in class is ever going to criticize your work, but you're shallow, you're facile. And the only person who can make you go deeper and make you do better work is you. I can't do it. Other kids in the class can't do it. You have to want something more for yourself. And it was one of those moments where someone kind of hits you and then everything changes. And I walked out of that meeting into a different world and thought, I don't have any interest at all in writing great television. And I don't know that I ever went on to write great literature, but at least that's the direction I've been shooting in ever since. And that's really because of him. I mean, maybe I would have come to that lesson later, but I feel when people give you that kind of advice, what they're really doing is saving you years and years of wandering around in the dark. And I appreciate that because it really feels more than anything like the gift of time. Yeah, I might have come to that on my own eventually, but you saved me that by just telling me.
And so what did you feel? I mean, you obviously took that lesson to heart, but was there some trepidation? Was there some sense that, can I go deeper?
No, there was no trepidation. I knew I could. I knew exactly what he was saying, and I knew he was right. You know, and life is like that all the time. I mean, if you're wearing an unflattering outfit or if you've made a dinner that really isn't very good, and if somebody calls you out on it, you're like, yeah, I knew that. I knew that. I knew I wasn't doing my best work. And obviously, if I had been doing my best work and I was shallow and facile, then I wouldn't have understood what he was talking about, and I wouldn't have been able to change it, and it wouldn't have made any sense to me. But because the criticism was so crystal clear to me, I really could just get to work on it immediately. I have always known about myself that I could have made a fortune in advertising. I have a brain that is particularly well-suited to jingles and stupid copy. I mean, I just would have been so good at that, at selling the world products they didn't want. I live in Nashville, and I have a friend, somebody that I've known for 15 years, who lives in the neighborhood, and we walk our dogs together. And he is a song producer, music producer, and he writes country music songs. And so sometimes we'll be complaining about our work, and I'll be complaining about how hard it is to write the novel I'm writing, and he'll be complaining about how hard it is to write the song he's writing. And I'm always saying, oh, Wally, give me a break, man. You're writing 3-minute rhyming couplets. This is not rocket science. So about 6 months ago, after years of talking about this, Wally finally said to me, "Come on, you know, let's write a song. Put your money where your mouth is. Let's see if you can do it, smarty." And it turns out I'm really good at it. I'm really good at writing about you've been out all night and you're cheating and days are through and I'm putting your bag on the doorstep, because I'm really good at writing crap. And Wally keeps saying to me, "This is unbelievable. You've got to do this all the time. We could just make a fortune. You're a gold mine." And it's not my calling.
Well, thank goodness for that.
It is really fun, though. You can really be stuck on a novel and pick up the phone and say, "Okay, Wally, let's write some really trashy country song. Let's go."
So that explains why you were able to write for 17 magazine and do freelancing, not because you're a writer, but precisely because you wanted to write other things. I think a lot of people would say, "Well, gee, if you're writing all day as a freelancer, how did you possibly have the emotional energy to write fiction?"
I wish we were on television so you could see me roll my eyes, but it's like writing a grocery list. I mean, if I'm writing pieces back in my 20s, I was writing for 17 magazine about how to decorate your locker or, you know, when the chemistry isn't there. That does not take away from fiction writing. You know, I was also a cook in a restaurant and later a waitress in a restaurant. That took away from fiction writing because I was just too tired at the end of the day to do anything. But I could turn out stupid articles about bridesmaids' dresses all day long, and it didn't take away from anything. It was so easy.
And your mom, you kind of had perhaps some kind of a model, I guess, because your mother is also a writer, and we've interviewed her on the show, Jean Ray. And she's also a nurse, a full-time nurse. Now that, I would imagine, would be hard to put together.
Well, of course, Mom's career didn't actually turn out that way. She was a full-time nurse, and she wanted to retire, and she didn't have the money to retire. And this is actually a very funny aside. My mother was the office nurse for the guy that I wound up marrying. So that's how I met my husband. He was my mother's boss. And my mother was wanting to retire. She was 60, and she was looking at the future, and she just didn't have enough money to retire. And we were talking about all the different things she could do, and I kept saying, "You need to write a novel. You know, you've always been really funny, and you're smart, and you were always a good writer, and we can do this." And so that's what she wound up doing. And I was my mother's personal trainer and bullied her a lot and kept saying, "Where's chapter four? I want to see chapter four." And that was how she was able to quit nursing. So my mother really wasn't writing all those years mm-hmm. that I was growing up and while she was nursing, but she always had it in her.
Right. We're talking with Ann Patchett about her marvelous collection of essays, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. It's out from HarperCollins. So we've talked about practice. You got to stick your butt to the chair every day. You also talk about forgiveness.
Yeah, that's huge. And I think that that is a real skill that I have that a lot of people don't have, which is no matter what you write, it's not ever going to be as good as what's in your head. And it's writing is a heartbreaking process in that sense, because I know the book that I have in my mind right now that I haven't started writing is so brilliant, is so wonderful. And once I start writing it, it's not going to be anymore. And it's going to break my heart. I'm going to break my heart. And the fact that I can say, this isn't what I want. This isn't the book that I can envision, but this is the best I can do. And always really doing my best, which was also a big transition point in my life, probably when I was about 25, that I finally decided to put writing first and to do my best work. Because before, you know, it was always I was breaking up with somebody, or I was broke, or I had to move. There was always some reason why I could look at the story I had just written and say, well, you know, it's okay, but it's not really my best work. And the advantage to doing that is if you know that you're not doing your best work, you don't know if you're 1% away or 90% away from your best work. So if you don't feel like you're doing your best work, you don't ever have to confront how bad you might actually be, or mediocre, or whatever. And so when I finally decided, okay, I'm going to start doing my best work, I also had to confront, you know, the fact that I was not Chekhov. I was not a genius. I was good, but I wasn't great. And I would have liked to have gone through my life believing that I was great, but instead I did my best work and I forgave myself for it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, you know that we are talking with Ann Patchett, novelist Ann Patchett, about her most recent book, which is a collection of essays, and it's This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. So when you're saying do your best, what are some of the elements, other than just parking your butt in the chair, what are some of the other elements of doing your best?
I think for me, and it would be different for everybody, but it's just a matter of calling myself out and writing a sentence and thinking, you know, that could be better. One thing that's really important to me at this point in my life, and I'm going to be 50 in a couple of months, is I'm so aware of time. I am aware of my own time. And I don't mean just, you know, as we hurtle through space towards our own death, although that's part of it, but I'm really busy. And I know everybody is really busy. And so if I'm going to write something, I want it to be worth your time. I want to say something that is in some way essential to me. And when I was 20, 25, 30, I didn't feel that way. I just felt like I was young and I was so interesting and everything I had to say was worth your time. I don't feel that way at all anymore. And when I sit down to write, I find myself constantly paring things down, wanting to get to the point as never before. You know, can I say this beautifully but in the fewest number of words? Because I have something I want to tell you, but I really don't want to take your whole day because I know how busy you are. And that, for me right now, is a big part of doing my best. And that's my dog, Sparky, barking in the background. He's also doing his best.
And you have some lovely, one lovely story, and she also appears in another story, Rosie.
Yeah.
Another dog of yours. You know, I just wonder if you would share something about her with our audience.
Well, we had Rose for 16 years, and she was, you know, my life. I really realized she was the being that I had spent more hours with than I had any other being in my life, more than my mother, more than my husband, more than my best friend, because I work at home and we were always together. She was a little white terrier, chihuahua kind of mutt that we found. And when I first got her, I was writing a lot for Vogue back then, and I wrote a piece about getting a dog and about being a woman who really didn't want to have kids but loved having a dog and how people tend to mess that up. Then years go by, and I stopped writing for Vogue, and they called me right after Rose had died. And I had really been thinking about writing about Rose, but I didn't, about her death, but I didn't know how. And Vogue called me. I hadn't written for them in probably 10 years. And this editor, who I had not worked with before, said, you know, we're doing this anniversary issue. We want to get all of our favorite writers back in the magazine. We want you to write the front piece for this issue. And I said, well, what do you want it about? He said, well, ideally, we would like a piece that was like that piece you wrote about getting your puppy. because that was the most popular piece we ever ran. You know, we had more mail about that piece than anything else. And I said, oh, well, my puppy just died, so should I write about that? And he was like, great, that would be perfect. And that was the kind of thing, and this is so often the case with me with nonfiction, I really needed an assignment. I couldn't just sit down and write it unless I was writing it for somebody. And it was to write about Rose's death was very, very difficult for me because I am a very cheerful, emotionally stable person, which is just the luck of the draw, my brain chemistry, what I came in with. And when she died, and she died at 16, I mean, just she had a fantastic life, I fell into this really crippling sadness. And I was so surprised. I knew she was going to die. I knew she was 16. That's the way it worked. But it was worse than kind of anything that I could have imagined. And I know that that's true for a lot of people. But it felt embarrassing to say, you know, my dog died. And I was in such a deep grief over it that it just completely knocked the breath out of me for months. So anyway, because I had agreed to write this piece and I had a deadline, I did it. I figured it out. How can I say this and sound credible to myself? And so many people, it's a piece that got passed around, so many people come up to me in the bookstore and say, oh, I read that piece about your dog dying. It was so helpful to me. My dog died. Or somebody will say, can I get a copy of that? I have a friend whose dog died. It was the only thing that really helped me when my dog died. And that's beautiful. I mean, that then I feel like, okay, my job on this earth is done. If I've given somebody else some comfort from that horrible experience, it helps me make sense of the experience.
And did it help you too?
Did it help me?
Mm-hmm. To write that.
No, it didn't help me. It didn't help with my grief to package it and write it, but it helped me to hear that it helped other people. And I do find with so many of these essays, when I went back and was reading through old essays, and there were hundreds of them, and I never really realized this, but the essays are where I put things. Happiness and sadness and poignancy, more than anything, that I can't carry it with me all through my life. So I put it down in writing, and then I put that away. And so I can say, oh, you know, there's the sadness over my friend Lucy or my grandmother dying or when my husband and I were dating and we broke up, but then we got back together. Those are experiences you just don't have the time and energy to go back and touch those again and again over the course of a day. But it's almost like I stick it in the pages of a book, like a leaf, and I press it. And I think, okay, now it's there. I know where it is.
Finally, let's get to the title story. Since you talk about your husband, this is a story of a happy marriage. As you mentioned before, your mother worked for him. He was a doctor. But before you met him, after kind of at the very end of your, what turned out to be the end of your first marriage, which ended in divorce, you met a guy at Yaddo while you were still married and had an affair with him, and somebody there told you something, gave you a piece of advice that you thought was absolutely critical when it comes to relationships, and I'd like you to share that with us.
Yes, it was a woman named Edra, and she had been divorced, and she asked me if my husband made me a better person. And I said, that just doesn't apply. That doesn't make any sense. It's so much more complicated than that. And she said, no, it's not. You know, does he make you a better person? Are you kinder, happier, more generous, a better writer? Are you better because you're with him? Or are you worse because you're with him? Are you a worse person because you're with him? And I certainly knew the answer, which was I was worse, but I couldn't accept that because my circumstances, and my gosh, I was 25 years old, my circumstances were so complicated and so hard and couldn't be reduced to such an easy question. And yet I look back on that as the moment where sort of everything turned, because it is true, and it becomes truer and truer as I get older. I just think it all boils down to, are you kind? Are you a good person? Are you leading a good life? Are you helpful? Do you make the way easier for other people? How can you be a better, kinder, more loving person? And that is exactly what my husband now makes me. He is a kind, generous, loving person, and I aspire to be more like him. He raises the bar for me every day because he's good. He's just really good, and he makes me, through his goodness, he makes me better. And it's a really simple construct that I think can be applied throughout our lives. You know, look at what we're doing. Is this making us better? Are we better in society? Are we better for the world because of what we're doing? And that's a nice thing to aim for.
Ann Patchett, this and many other beautiful insights are in your latest book. This is the story of a happy marriage. Thanks so much. It's been a privilege to talk with you today.
Thank you. I had such a nice time. I appreciate it.
Ann Patchett. You can read an excerpt from This is the Story of a Happy Marriage at writersvoice.net. Next up, we air our 2012 interview with Ann Patchett's mother, novelist Jean Ray. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. If you're anywhere past 40, especially if you're a woman, you've probably experienced the sudden sense that you're invisible. Heads don't turn the way they used to when you were young and nubile. But what if you woke up one day and found that you were really invisible, as in when you looked in the mirror, you saw nothing at all? That's what happened to Clover, the protagonist in Jean Ray's novel, Calling Invisible Women. The funny thing is, her husband and son don't even notice she's invisible, although her best friend does. Eventually, Clover discovers she's not alone. She joins a support group for invisible women, and together they unravel the cause of their condition and learn some important lessons about themselves and how they want to relate to others. Jean Ray worked as a registered nurse for 40 years before she wrote her first novel at the age of 60. She's the New York Times bestselling author of the novels Julie and Romeo, Eat Cake, and Step Ball Change. She's also the mother of writer Ann Patchett, who we spoke with in today's first segment. I did this interview with Jean Ray in 2012. Now, you have written several novels before this wonderful novel, Calling Invisible Women. I read it in one delicious bite. This is your fifth. First, I want to ask you a little bit about your writing, because you tend to write about a subject that I think a lot of people don't write about. That is women of a, quote, certain age, unquote. You started writing when you were 60, is that right? Or publishing?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Writing.
writing when you were 60. My goodness. Mm-hmm. And was that a long time coming, or was that just a fancy that took you over?
Well, both, really. I had always had a yearning to be a writer. And that's really all it was, is a yearning. My parents were Depression-era people, and they wanted nothing more than for me to have an education which would provide a way for me to earn money for myself, that I would not ever be alone and without a job. So that's why I became a nurse, and I loved nursing. I have to say, I have no regrets about nursing. But years and years of nursing, and I never stopped loving it. But when I was 60, I had recently remarried, and I was very, very happy in my marriage. I was very, very happy in the current job that I had as a nurse, working for an internist here in Nashville. And it was before the baby boomers kind of came marching into our lives. And so there was very little publicity for older people. And I used to see magazine covers that said beauty at 20, 30, and 40, or sex at 30, 40, and 50. And I, at 60, felt really rejected and felt as though I had dropped off the edge of some precipice. And it bothered me for a while in sort of a depressing way. And then I thought, I've got to do something about this. I've got to move on this. I've got to write something about this. And consequently, I wrote Julie and Romeo, which is about two aging lovers from very conflicted families who go ahead with their love. And I wanted the people in the novel to be savvy and funny and have good energy and be attractive and be sexual, so that perhaps someone who picked up my story could see that 60-year-olds can be this way. And as it happened, I had just read Romeo and Juliet and thought that would make a perfect plot, which it really did. It's something that I am very thankful to Shakespeare for. And the book went over. It sold very well. It got to the New York Times bestseller list. And that sort of started, well, not sort of, it started my career then as a writer. And I just went to work nursing at part-time and began writing more. And then in the last 5 years, I think I've been very happy and content. My husband and I moved into a new house. There have been a lot of changes in our lives. So I hadn't written anything until, again, I was deeply moved by this invisible woman thing. So that's my story as a writer. And as you probably know, my daughter is a writer and very well known and has the education of a writer. So she helped me with a lot of things like transitioning from chapter to chapter and a lot of technicalities that I wouldn't know as a nurse. I had the heart, but I didn't have the brain for it.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, and your daughter's Anne Padgett. Since you've mentioned it, is there any kind of mother-daughter rivalry? It sounds like it's been more on the cooperative end of that.
It's a very cooperative relationship. We are deep friends. We're together almost every day. She lives two blocks from where I do. And we just see each other and help each other whenever we can. We don't talk so much about writing anymore. I mean, she writes her things, and then I usually read them in manuscript form and tell her what I think. And I write my things, and the same is true there. But we're not deeply involved in one another's decisions about plots and characters.
Well, I have to say, calling Invisible Women is a very tightly written, wonderfully plotted book. I just loved it. And with a great dry or wry humor to it as well. It starts when a 50-something Clover Hobart, your protagonist, looks in the mirror one day and she discovers that she's invisible. Do you happen to have the book there?
I do have a book here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I wonder if you could turn to page 21 and just read for us this paragraph. Now, I believe this is the day after that she found that she was invisible in the mirror, and then she becomes visible again briefly.
Right.
And then becomes invisible again. So set us up. Tell us what's happening here. And read this paragraph. It starts with, "And so I waited," and then just read that one paragraph. But first, tell us what's happening.
Okay. In the first chapter, everything kind of gets set up. As you said, Clover gets out of the shower and notes that she is indeed invisible. She's very frightened. She tries to call her husband at work. He's a pediatrician. He's very, very busy, and the nurses won't let her talk to him because he's so busy. And she is frustrated, and she goes in and wakes up her son, who has come home after college because he can't find a job. And he's just kind of sarcastic and pissed off because she woke him. And then she sees herself return to her flesh. She talks to her best friend and neighbor, Gilda. And although Gilda is very sympathetic, she doesn't see her at that time when she's invisible. So that's pretty much the first chapter. I think one comes to the reality that Clover is certainly in a frustrating situation. Although she loves her husband, she loves her children, she has grown used to being used by them, as most families do, use the female matriarch in the family. So there are many ways in which Clover has become invisible to her family before she actually becomes invisible physiologically. So I suppose that sets it up.
It does.
All right. Then on page 21, this paragraph begins, "And so I waited, my invisible arms behind my invisible head." She's in bed, by the way. "Of course, I didn't know exactly when I'd vanished yesterday. Could it have been in the shower? Was it possible that I could have washed my hair without realizing I was gone? And then something else occurred to me, something darker and more unsettling. What if yesterday wasn't the first time? What if I had been flickering in and out for a while now, in my sleep or in the car or in the kitchen chopping vegetables? It had been years since I'd really kept an eye on myself. Could I be positive how long this had been going on?"
This has just really struck me because I can actually remember the day, the time, where I was when I realized that I was invisible. You know, it was in my 40s. You know, I think I was 40, I just turned 40.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that I no longer got the attention that I used to get. So unwanted attention, it often was, but it just suddenly struck me that nobody ever looked at me anymore.
That's right. That's right. I know. I remember the same thing.
Yeah, it's quite a shock. So this is a metaphor, but it's also, you really play with this metaphor and make it real here. So your protagonist, Clover Hobart, finds other women in her same situation when she comes across a classified ad. Tell us about that.
She was a newspaper reporter full time, and so she's interested in the paper, although I think that their little paper has sort of shrunk down to nothing, is quickly becoming invisible itself. And she likes to look through the want ads to see, A, if she could find a job for Nick, her son, and then B, to see if she could find something that she could be doing outside the home. And it's a habit with her. And she comes across an ad that she hasn't noticed before, which says, calling invisible women at the Sheraton Hotel at 10 o'clock the following day. And she really gets excited. And the next day then goes to the Sheraton. And through, I think, what is rather a group of funny situations, she meets all these other invisible women. She doesn't know how many are there. And they're all nude because when they wear their clothes are visible. So,
and they don't want to be discovered.
No, and they don't want to be discovered. And they don't rent this room that they meet in because nobody sees them anyway. So it's just a funny situation. They all carry Kleenex so that they won't sit on each other.
I love this. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jean Ray about her newest novel, Calling Invisible Women. You know, I could almost see how you were, your thought process, you know, how you were kind of discovering in this book all the implications of what it means to be invisible. You know, the kind of, I think most of us, we just stop thinking about it once we realize we are invisible to many people. But you actually discover through this book that there are some advantages, and these women, including Clover, really turn those advantages in their favor.
Yes, they do. I think they discover a great deal about themselves as well as discovering what the probable cause of their invisibility is. One of the things I really like about the book and am pleased with is that, and I think I said this before, but it's that we all do become metaphorically invisible, and Clover certainly had. And yet, when she became physically invisible, she learned so much about herself. She learned so much about her own self-importance and the importance of others. And she became a leader and consequently was very visible even in her invisibility.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the thing I mean is I think we could all of us who are aging women and are no longer particularly interesting or attractive to others, whether it be men or women, I think we lose sight of the fact that we can become visible by thinking about other people and not thinking about ourselves, by extending kindnesses. Not in the way Clover did as sort of this household slave, but may I give you an example?
Oh, please do.
The other night I went out to dinner with a woman friend. She and I are good friends. And we were seated at a table in a restaurant, and we were facing each other. So she could see over my left shoulder that there was a table full of people, a large party. And suddenly, in the middle of dinner, she stood up and she walked over to that table, and I thought, oh, well, she must know someone there. And she had noticed that there was a woman at the table that was taking pictures of everybody, and she realized that the woman herself would not be in the pictures. So she just went over and offered to take pictures for her so that she could be in part of the pictures. And I thought that was a stunning thing to do. I mean, she kind of put herself out on a limb because the people could have been, I don't know, insulted or think that she was trying to steal her camera or whatever. And yet she did a real service for no reason other than that she noticed someone was in need.
It's like one of your characters, the mother, Clover's mother-in-law.
Yes.
She tells Clover at one point that the lesson may be not who sees you, but who you can learn to see.
Right. And exactly.
So how does, are you saying that invisibility does that because in a way it frees us from having to be involved with our appearance?
Oh, I think that's part of it, but I don't think that's the main part of it. I think maybe not our own attractiveness, but our own needs or fears or feeling that someone won't like us or be angry at us. We can extend our, we could extend ourselves more fully, I think, if we were invisible. We could allow ourselves to take chances that we don't take when we're visible.
Right. And Clover does this quite a bit. I mean, there's a number of ways. She does good works with others. She confronts a man in a parking lot who's abusing his girlfriend or his wife. But she also ends up doing some volunteer work in a school. And I love that. Talk a little bit about what she does there.
Well, number one, this wouldn't be Clover's favorite thing to do, but one of the women that she meets at the Invisible Woman's Group is a former teacher of her children, of Clover's children, and she likes her very much. And the former teacher really kind of encourages Clover to do some work at the school, and particularly on the school bus, where I think a lot of bullying and making fun of lesser students was taking place. And so Clover and this other teacher get on the bus, and of course the kids don't know it, and then they just go about the business of making room for the kid, for the poor child that nobody will make room for because they're too thin or too fat or something's wrong with them in the eyes of the other students. And they whisper things in the kids' ears to scare them, and they have, I thought, a lot of fun doing this. I don't know. I think they were pretty exhausted when it was over, but what an adventure that would be.
Yeah, they whisper things in the ears of the bullies to kind of get them to withdraw a bit. It's just lovely. It was really, you really got a sense of the possibilities of what one could do there, you know. And I think one of the other characters says, invisible women are needed everywhere. You know, I would like to be in a hedge fund or on Wall Street.
Yes.
That's great. Now, so there's another plot line here in this book, and we're talking with Jean Ray about her wonderful novel. It's just a terrific read. It's called Calling Invisible Women. And that plot line is that there is a medical mystery at the heart of this physical invisibility. Now, I don't want to do any spoilers here, but tell us what you can about this aspect of the plot.
Well, when Clover meets with all these other invisible women, they explain to her that they have had the foresight to do a survey of what each of them has, what medications each of them have been taking along the way. And they found that there were three medications that all of them had taken or were taking. And they're medications which would be very common to any woman past menopause. One was a bone rebuilder, Ostefos, I think I called it. One was a mood elevator, Singsol. And by the way, I love that name, Singsol. And one was an estrogen supplement. And they were all three made by the same pharmaceutical company. And they also had at some time at least one shot of Botox, but they weren't sure that that was influential in the whole invisibility thing. But they really became quite positive. Clover herself took those three medications, that those were the three meds that were rendering them invisible. And they do a lot more investigative work, and they go to the pharmaceutical company, and that's quite a big adventure.
Yeah, and I think we can leave that right there. Tell us, is there anything else that I haven't asked that you'd like to, a point you'd like to make about the book?
One thing that came up for me when I was giving a talk somewhere was several women in the room who had read the book said, you know, this really could be a self-help book. And although I really don't want to think of it as a self-help book, I think that my intentions were such that it could be something that women who were feeling invisible could read and perhaps find that they could do something about their invisibility, their metaphorical invisibility.
Yeah, in fact, that brings up a thought that I had, which is, you know, when you were talking before that being invisible can maybe leave you freer to do kindnesses or do good deeds for others, but also mm-hmm. this character in the book, as well as the other women, Clover Hobart, she really comes into her own in a very strong way. And I find it ironic, in a sense, that, you know, as I became more invisible, and I don't think there's necessarily a connection between the two, but as I became more invisible as I aged, also because I aged, I became more confident about who I was and what my kid, you know, I just gained an experience and wisdom.
That's right.
And I don't know if that there's a connection or it's just an irony that that's what happens.
I don't know either if there's a connection or if it's irony, but certainly that happened to me. I think I was most invisible chronically when I was in high school because I didn't have any idea who I was or where I was going. And I think as I became older, even though I went through certain periods where I wasn't getting that bling from being smashing pretty anymore, and I missed that, but then I found other ways to fill up that place, that hole in my life, and I think they were all very constructive ways. I mean, I started to write books, for one thing.
That was my 2012 interview with Jean Ray about her novel, Calling Invisible Women. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.